Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Last year, a study published in the medical journal The Lancet warned that without immediate action, we will face an escalating crisis of overweight and obesity across the United States. According to the study, in a little over two decades, almost 260 million people in the United States are predicted to have an overweight or obesity problem, including 43.1 million children and adolescents. And if we don't address this crisis, 80% of Americans could be overweight or obese by the year 2050. So what is behind this obesity epidemic that's impacting tens of millions of people just here in the U.S. alone? Well, in her new book, Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola, our guest today, Professor Susan Greenhall, tells the story of how Coca-Cola mobilized allies in academia to create a soda defense science that would protect profits by advocating for exercise and not dietary restraint as a priority solution to obesity, a view that few experts accept. Susan Greenhall is the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University. She's the author of several books, including Fat Talk Nation, The Human Costs of America's War on Fat, and Under the Medical Gaze, Facts and Fictions of Chronic Pain, as well as Cultivating Global Citizens, Population and the Rise of China. And her new book that we're going to discuss today is Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. Welcome to the program, Professor Greenhall.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you join us. And thank you for this very revealing and important book, and congratulations on it. Now, we've been increasingly getting confusing and contradictory messages about health food and wellness. And at the same time, Americans continue to be obsessed with slimming down, and we're facing this obesity epidemic all at once. So how concerning is the obesity problem in the U.S., especially among children? Can you just describe what's happening now with obesity in this country?
It's very concerning. Your statistics that you just cited saying that by 2050, it could be that 80% of the population has obesity overweight. We're almost there. It's about 74, 75% now. What's concerning is that the numbers just keep going up and up, and there doesn't seem to be any way to seriously intervene in this trend.
And what are some of the ramifications just in terms of the environment, in terms of what's happening to our culture? Can you just paint a picture of what obesity does to us, even beyond the individual health impacts?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, it has major impacts on the culture. People are, among other things, people are just obsessed with losing weight. And other than the new drugs that have been introduced recently to induce rapid weight decline, there really aren't any effective measures. So it drives people crazy as they try ever harder to change their diets and their exercise patterns to get rid of excess pounds. And it just doesn't work. I don't know that I could speak to the environmental effects very easily. Certainly the public health people estimate the tens of billions of dollars spent. What really matters to me is the really serious diseases that tend to be associated with obesity. Much more likely to get heart disease, certain cancers, type 2 diabetes. All these really debilitating diseases are much more likely if you become obese. And obese is not just a matter of pounds. It's a condition of metabolic dysfunction inside the body that's very concerning.
And can you talk a bit about the history of obesity, just particularly here in the United States? As I understand from reading your book, it really began to explode in the 1990s in particular. So can you talk about the sort of the trend lines and the rates of change in obesity in this country over the last number of decades?
Yes, the dates are really significant. It was only in the mid-90s that American public health scientists realized that rates of obesity were going up. Historically, they assumed that about 25% of the adult population tended to be obese. But starting in the mid-90s, new data show that starting in the late 70s and especially the 1980s, rates began to go up, up, up. And so by the early 90s, something like a third more than had been anticipated were actually overweight. And then the numbers kept going up and up. And by the end of the 1990s, U.S. public health authorities, like the Surgeon General, had declared that obesity was becoming an epidemic in the U.S. And since then, the numbers have just continued to rise.
Well, then, of course, you know, I'm sure listeners are asking, well, what happened? Why did obesity start taking off in the 1990s? What does the science, the evidence suggest?
What it suggests is that changes in lifestyles, live, and in the environment in which people choose their lifestyle patterns are what lies behind these trends. In particular, the increasing consumption of what's now called ultra-processed food, food and drinks, basically junk food and drinks. In the 70s, the Big Soda began to find much cheaper ways to put sweetness into their drinks. And so portions were increased, even as the cost per unit of these foods and drinks fell. The quality of these things became much, much more compromised. So people eating a lot more junk food, exercising a lot less. And these things were due to larger changes in the economy, like newer technology made it possible for people to work without exerting as much exercise. So these vast changes, and yet in the 1990s, when the obesity epidemic began to come into view and scientists were beginning to figure out what to do about it, it was really unclear. No clear solution had yet emerged.
And can you put this into an international context for us? I know you spent a lot of time in China in particular. Can you talk about what was happening globally at the same time as the obesity crisis was getting worse in the United States?
Well, the global situation was much less visible. People didn't pay attention. But as a matter of fact, in places like China and other major, that is large size, countries in the global south with big populations, very similar trends were taking place. In China, the obesity epidemic was at a lower level, but the trend over time was the same as in the US. Starting in the early 80s, it began to rise. And that, not coincidentally, is exactly when fast food came to China. Fast food arrived in China in 1987, and the Chinese just loved it. They didn't love the food so much, but they loved going to these restaurants because it gave them a taste of American-style modernity. Around the world, in Mexico, Coca-Cola and other big soda companies, the quality of the water in Mexico was not that good. And big soda companies persuaded the public that that sugary soda would be an excellent substitute for water. So consumption of sugary soda has been very high in Mexico. And accordingly, diseases like obesity and diabetes have just grown.
And you have a pretty disturbing passage in your book, a sort of an excerpt summary of what happens to the human body when we drink Coca-Cola. And I'm sure you haven't memorized it, but just wondering if you can just summarize some of the key sort of physiological processes that happen when we drink a soda like Coke. Well, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Absolutely. Yeah. The key physiological processes. First of all these teaspoons of sugar get dumped into your system. You don't immediately get sick from all the sugar going into you because the various phosphoric acid cuts the flavor. Blood sugar spikes, causing an insulin burst. Your liver responds to this by turning all that extra sugar into fat. And then you feel really high about 30, 40 minutes in. You get a caffeine high. Then about 45 minutes, your body ups its dopamine production, stimulating the pleasure centers of your brain. So you're feeling really good about then. Then 60 minutes in, you have high doses of sugar, artificial sweeteners, increasing the excretion. And then after 60 minutes, you begin to fall. Energy sinks, you slag, you want another Coke.
It's really a remarkable process. You know, I think most of us intuitively maybe understand some of these effects, but the science behind it is really something, particularly talking about just how much sugar is in each Coca-Cola. And you did mention that in the 1990s, Coke had decided to really push for larger portion sizes. Can you talk about why what was going on at the company's reasoning, why their business model was changing. I mean, this is a company that had been around for, you know, perhaps a better part of a century before then. Why? And they were doing okay financially, I would assume. So what was behind their choice to change the product size?
Yeah, all along the agenda has been to get more Coca-Cola into people's bodies. And that actually, the supersizing of these very unhealthy products happened earlier, actually, in the 1970s and the 1980s. So they discovered they could produce Coke at a per unit basis much more cheaply. So what they did is they increased the size without increasing the cost proportionately. And then they get people to drink more and more soda. And then with lower costs for these larger sodas, then it's much more profitable business model.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating story and such a huge impact on public health. I want to let listeners know that you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about what Big Soda did to try to confuse the public on the science behind obesity. And our guest, Susan Greenhall, who is the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University, has written the book Soda Science: Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola, that really unpacks this story. And Susan, let me ask you how you got interested in this story. What made you decide to focus on what Big Food, Big Soda was doing to try to address and essentially combat the calls for regulation of their products in response to this obesity epidemic?
Exactly. In the early 2010s, new research by investigative journalists came out showing how these big companies had been taste engineering their food, things like potato chips, cookies, ice cream, all that stuff that we love, engineering these foods so that they became addictive to us, so that the more we ate, the more we wanted to eat. So who can open a bag of chips and stop at two? Well, I certainly can. I absolutely have to eat the whole thing. But that was deliberate. And I began thinking, if they were engineering the taste, maybe they were engineering the science. Maybe they were engineering the policy behind obesity, and that's what I wanted to study.
Well, it's an amazing hunch that you pursued. Can you talk then about what the industry's playbook was essentially in response to the recognition of the obesity crisis starting back in the 1990s and some of these calls to regulate big soda, things like sugar taxes and other types of regulatory approaches? What were they doing in response to that, to those calls?
Yes, the industry was really on it. When the news of an impending obesity epidemic arose, the industry realized this was an existential threat coming its way. And way back, so this was the mid-90s, two decades earlier, Coke and several other large food companies had set up an industry-funded scientific nonprofit that was going to create science that would advance the interests of the food industry. So in the mid-1990s, it mobilized that organization. It was called the International Life Sciences Institute, or ILSI for short. It mobilized it to begin to think about what science it could create to neutralize the threat of the obesity epidemic. And there was a big meeting at this organization, a big meeting of the CEOs of about a dozen top food companies in 1999. And scientists from ILSI presented a proposal that the U.S. adopt a countrywide program supported by the industry to work on better eating and more exercise as the solution. And what the CEO said was, no, we are not changing our food recipe at all. We can promote exercise, but we can't promote better eating. So the science that ILSI came up with was to promote more exercise. Exercise as the priority solution to obesity. They always said that better food was important, but the actual science itself paid little attention to the food. And so there was a second tenet of this new science also, which was that regulation was not necessary. Soda taxes, restrictions on marketing to young children were not necessary. And so starting 1999 and moving forward, ILSI was at the center of this broad movement where it recruited selective academic scientists to work with it to create this science. I call it soda defense science. And so what does that mean? Soda defense science is created not to solve a problem like obesity, but to find a scientific solution to obesity that would defend industry against threats to its profits. And that was just a perfect solution because everybody knows that exercise is good for us. So to push it a little farther and say exercise is the top solution to obesity made intuitive sense, even though scientifically there was very little, there was actually no support for it.
We're speaking with Professor Susan Greenhall, the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University, about her new book, Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. And I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. If you are a soda drinker and have thoughts about the impact of soda on your life, if you are in favor of more regulations on soda, sugar taxes, soda taxes, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email any questions or comments that you might have to yourcall@kalw.org. Susan, I wanted to follow up with you on this. Really, it feels very insidious, and the soda science, as you call it, I mean, that's the title of your book, that exercise is really the best way to address the obesity problem. Can you talk about why your book is called Soda Science and why that message is not junk science, but it's very misleading?
Right. I think that the science-ness of these ideas, were presented as a science. They were spread by leading scientists, top researchers from some public universities in the country. They were published in top journals like Science Magazine, Pediatrics, and other leading journals. So they were presented to the world as science. The scientists behind them also were constantly giving public lectures. They were their talks were reported in the media by scientists, scientific journalists, and so they had the status of truth. And yet, they were not supported by very many data. The data strongly suggested that dietary solutions were much more important. And yet, there were these two warring sciences out there. The one promoted by most public health researchers, which was diet is more important, although exercise plays an important role, and then the one by the soda scientists. But interestingly, none of the public health researchers came out publicly and challenged the soda scientists to say, let's see your data. It was like a live and let live. And so the soda scientists actually had a big place in the public imagination. And I think these ideas that exercise was really big were very appealing to a large number of industries in the sports and fitness area. So now that some of these soda scientists were saying exercise is the main solution to obesity, then the people who had gyms, sports equipment, Peloton bicycles, all these companies, they could promote their products as addressing the obesity epidemic. And even today, a very large proportion of American adults have extra pounds on their body and they want to lose weight. So these kinds of messages are appealing. But in this way, this simple notion that exercise works for obesity can spread far and wide. The fact is, though, that recent research shows that if you're just using exercise to address excess weight, it has just a marginal effect. You can lose some weight for sure, but not very much. And secondly, it's really short term. The vast majority of people, something like 95% of people, put the weight back on again. So it just doesn't work.
That's such an interesting strategy. It's this kind of half truth that sure, exercise is good for you, but it's not going to address the obesity challenge, and is particularly not as effective as addressing the dietary factors and the sugar intake from soda. So it's pretty fascinating how the industry really glommed onto this. And let's talk more about the industry and their role kind of behind the scenes supporting and promoting this sort of half truth about how to address the obesity crisis. And you did mention ILSI, the International Life Sciences Institute. It's a pretty fascinating example of how corporations can impact and influence the science debate. Can you talk more about ILSI and why and how it was created?
ILSI is a fascinating organization these days. To tell the truth, this story about Coca-Cola funding this soda defense science, this story came out in the New York Times. There was a big expose in late 2015. My part of the story, which also takes us to China, came out much later, in particular in this book. But research shows that Coke had a major role beyond funding ILSI. So Coca-Cola invested very heavily in grants to, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of scientists working in similarly hundreds of organizations who published all sorts of articles suggesting that exercise was more important and that soda was not a major factor behind the increase. Most of them work through ILSI. ILSI is a really important organization because even though it's industry funded, it's registered as a nonprofit. And in order to be to fit the legal requirement for nonprofit, two things have to be true. First of all, you have to serve the public interest, not private interests. That's what's really important, because ILSI was serving private interests of big food, not public interests of lowering weight.
And you've also talked about in the book how this is really what you might call product defense science. You describe it also as soda defense science in this particular context, but this is clearly something that a number of industries do. And since I work primarily on climate change, I couldn't help but see the tie-in to how the fossil fuel industry has tried to confuse the public on the science behind climate change. Are there other analogies and other industry contexts? Can you maybe put this into a bigger picture? I know that wasn't the focus of your study, but how typical is it that industry is trying to distort the science when they have a product that is causing harm to the public?
This is one of the most alarming things I learned in doing research for the book. Public health researchers, in particular David Michaels, who works in DC, they've shown that every single industry that makes a product that's damaging to human health or to the environment, every single one of those industries fosters a science meant to save its product, to defend its product against charges from public health researchers and charges that come through lawsuits that the product is harming the human health or the environment. So it's really pervasive. I think that this kind of pattern is much more common than people realize. What I did, so I'm an anthropologist, and I love to dig deep, 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 deep into behind the scene, underneath the surface of institutions and scientific articles, and see what's really going on. What are the hidden connections? What are the networks that tie people together? What are the flows of money that are funding these things? And so what's distinctive about my work is I've taken the science apart. I've followed these scientists over time, in particular over about 20 years, from the mid-90s to the mid-2010s, read their articles, taken them apart, look at the kind of data they use, look at the arguments that they are not making, look at where the money is coming from in order to put together this story. So it actually took me 10 years to do this project, starting from the very beginning when I had a hunch. And it really didn't become a project about Coca-Cola until several years into the story, because I started out also looking at Big Pharma. And then it ended up that Big Food was really the big story. But it took a very long time to write this. And then it took a long time to publish it. I wanted to start out publishing this material. Well, actually, shall I talk about the China part of the project?
Well, I would love to hear about that. I do want listeners to hear about your involvement in China, but I want to take a short break. We have so much more to cover with you, our guests, Professor Susan Greenhall, John King, and Wilma Cannon Fairbank, Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. We're talking about the role of big soda in confusing the public on the science behind obesity. So Professor Greenhall will have more with you. So stay with us shortly. We'll be back shortly after this break here. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information on our website at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. We've been speaking with Susan Greenhall, the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University, the author of several books, including Fat Talk Nation, The Human Costs of America's War on Fat, and Under the Medical Gaze, Facts and Fictions of Chronic Pain, and Cultivating Global Citizens, Population and the Rise of China. But her new book is called Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. And we're talking to her about the role of big soda in confusing the public around the science behind obesity. And we want to hear from you as well. What do you think we should do about the impact of soda on our health? Do you have thoughts about a soda tax or other regulatory approaches to try to limit the negative consequences of soda on the obesity epidemic here in the United States and nationally? The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Well, Susan, we were speaking about your work in China, and that was a big part of the book. You obviously go through what happened in the United States with Big Soda's approach to trying to stymie regulation on their product, but then you pivot to how this was playing out in China, rapidly developing country. Can you talk about more about China and how the industry-funded science was starting to distort the facts about junk food and sugary drinks in that country?
Yes, countries like China are really important for us to understand, because in places like the US, we have just a huge civil society here. Companies can't get away with too much in this country, or they can get away, but not for very long, because we have NGOs, we have critical public intellectuals, we have people doing podcasts. People are constantly watching. Americans are suspicious of big corporations. And when they, when corporate greed is just harms human health, people will speak up. In a place like China with an authoritarian government, people do not have the right to speak out about such things. And so corporations can get away with doing a lot of bad things to the country and to the society. And I have worked on China my whole career. I find it just a fascinating place and often not that well understood by Americans. So this case is just a terrible case of Big Soda taking advantage of what was then a developing country that didn't have a very strong public health network. So it was in the US, remember, that in 1999 that soda science was first devised. It was in 2004 that soda science began to travel to places like China. ILSI transported it. ILSI, that industry-funded nonprofit that made corporate-friendly science, was based in the U.S., based in D.C., but it had branches all around the world. About 15 branches, and a main branch was in China. And in 1999, ILSI asked all its branches to take up the obesity problem, suggesting that the ideal solution would be to promote exercise. And, you know, all these organizations, these ILSI branches, they're also funded by industry. So people follow what industry wants to do. And over the next 10, 15 years, ILSI began sponsoring scientific conferences in China on the obesity problem in that country. And who are the main scientists invited to present the best of international science? Well, they're none other than the soda scientists from the US. They were invited to China. Their ideas about exercise first, nothing said about soda taxes. Their ideas were presented as the best. And so working together, ILSI and these American scientists persuaded the Chinese that these ideas under the rubric soda science were authoritative notions about obesity for China. And then Chinese scientists working with ILSI there in Beijing got these ideas embedded in Chinese policy. So it was ILSI's branch in China that was responsible for making the two first and most important Chinese policies on obesity, promoting exercise, no surprise, and lifestyle changes. And then over time, those obesity-only policies have been built into China's policies on chronic disease more generally. So they're still there. You can find Koch's fingerprints all over China's policies on chronic disease, even today. And yet, who is going to discover that? Nobody but the foreign anthropologists, because Chinese are not able to look through the history of their policy, pull out the fingerprints of Koch, and complain about it. Things work in a much more top-down fashion. It can be very dangerous for them to do something like that. So these effects of soda science are really pervasive, and they're also very invisible. Speaking about insidious, I mean, China's policies generally, China's health policies are very industry friendly, and they have been for decades. That's sort of the fundamental basis of Chinese development has been marketization. You know, let the market take the lead, let the companies do what they want. Even the soda companies were actually sitting at the policy table in China when these policies were being devised. And so I think we need to think beyond the borders of the U.S. and realize how these U.S.-based institutions, which are sometimes global in scope, can have impacts that are really terrible, even worse than the impacts that we feel here in our own country.
Such a fascinating part of the story to uncover, just the role of what's happening internationally, particularly in a place like China, just so important economically, just in terms of its population size, and then, of course, with the geopolitics happening. And I think you really make the point in the book, it becomes quite apparent just how the authoritarian nature of government and governance in China really affects how this science is able to take root there, or this soda science, as you call it, is able to take root there. And I want to talk to you about some of the people involved. I think the sort of cast of characters that your book describes is pretty fascinating. And Chen Ming seems to be the central person in China to this story, or at least to your book version of it. Can you talk about Chen Ming? Who is she, and what was her role?
Just a lovely person and somebody that the Chinese admire very much. Born very early in the 20th century, she actually was the daughter of a gentleman who was a personal secretary to Chiang Kai-shek, who was the leader of the nationalist government on Taiwan. So that's quite an irony. So her father actually left for Hong Kong, and Chen Chengming, the daughter, stayed in China. She studied nutrition. Right after the Second World War, she was a leading nutritionist, that is getting like a bachelor in science in nutrition. Then during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, she was a nutritional and health researcher in the central scientific agencies of the government. Then in the 1980s, she was named director of an institute within the health ministry that worked on chronic diseases. But by that time, the reforms under Deng Xiaoping had started, and the reforms involved defunding science, defunding health, and letting economic growth take the lead. So she and her colleagues found that there was no money to do nutrition research. So then when ILSI came along and wanted to set up a branch in China in the early 1990s, Chen Shengming was thrilled to cooperate. So Chen became the head of the ILSI branch in China. Chen was her, I interviewed her at length in the late 2013. Her English was excellent. She's very savvy, very global and savvy and sophisticated. She'd been involved in a number of international UN organized activities. But she played this dual role. It's a really quite challenging role because on the one hand, as a Chinese scientist and an ex-official of the health ministry, she had to be loyal to her government. She had to serve Chinese interests. On the other hand, here she was working within ILSI. And so in ILSI, her masters are these huge foreign companies. And so she had to make it seem like she was serving both groups' interests at the same time. So what she did is she brought all these American scientists to China. In China, as in many countries in the global South, there's this tremendous respect for and admiration of American science. And the US CDC is considered just the lead organization in public health everywhere. And so Chinese wanted to emulate American science. So she brought soda science to China. She presented it as American science, not as corporate science, even though it was corporate science, and got it adopted as American science. So she was the one who personally created these two major obesity policies in China that reflected the input of soda science. And did she understand what she was doing? Did she understand that the science and policy she was bringing to China were deeply influenced by Big Soda? She would never acknowledge that she did. She certainly realized that industry was paying for all the work they were doing. But I think that she very successfully blinded herself to the reality of what was going on. And back then, that is before the big expose in 2015, nobody had any idea that Coke was intervening and creating soda science. That all came out in a flash in 2015. So it's not surprising that she didn't realize, but she was in a very compromised position. And she's now passed away, and her legacy is honored. Nobody would ever criticize her. And so, you know, I worry that my book might not get full attention it could use to have in China because of what I say about her. But I just followed the facts and wanted to tell people what I found about how she handled this very difficult, contradictory position she occupied.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Harvard anthropology professor Susan Greenhall, the author of Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we want to hear from you. If you have questions or Professor Greenhall, the number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email any questions to yourcall@klw.org. And Susan, wanted to follow up on this really fascinating kind of personality here in China. But how then did Coca-Cola affect public policy in China? What was a translation from ILSI and, you know, and on the individuals involved to actually policy changes on the ground in China?
Yeah, great, great question. So Chen Shengming occupied multiple roles. She was head of the ILSI branch in China, but as a former high-level public health official, remember she was head of that chronic disease division of the Ministry of Health, in China, once an official, always an official. So she had very high status. In China, people are connected through a process known as guanxi. It means deep personal connections. And everybody in the Ministry of Health had good guanxi with Chen Shengming. That meant they trusted her. Essentially, the Ministry of Health outsourced the making of obesity policy to Chen Shengming. She made the policy. She described this process to me, how she personally made the policy, wrote it up, submitted it, sent it around to 10 or so of her colleagues in the scientific community to get their input, revised the policy measure. Then she communicated with the Ministry of Health and she said, you know what, we have a serious obesity problem. I think that we need some guidelines, don't you? And so the health ministry said, yes, I think we need some guidelines. Would you like to make them? And so she just sent her guidelines over. And then the Ministry of Health revised them a few times, and then they were adopted as official policy. It's just that simple. Yeah. Things are very personal in China. So she hand created these COPE-friendly policies for the Chinese government.
Well, we have an email in from Ken in San Francisco who asks, who were the scientists in the U.S. who collaborated with Koch, and did they face any consequences?
Great question. There were four scientists in particular, and among those two that were even more important. One was at the University of Colorado, a leading obesity specialist, and the other was at the University of South Carolina. He was a major internationally renowned specialist in physical activity and health. And these two were very much in the news in very negative light in 2015 when it came out that Coca-Cola had devoted $20 million to funding something called International Energy Balance Network, the Energy Balance Network, Global Energy, GEBN, Global Energy Balance Network. And these two scientists were the head of it. And so that was a huge scandal. And Coca-Cola, after this, Coca-Cola fired its chief health and science officer. Coca-Cola stopped funding soda science. And so this network had to be abandoned.
And this all happened in 2015. I know you referenced that was the big sort of turning point.
It happened in 2015. So what happened to these scientists? So the one at the University of Southern California, he retired with a glorious name in retirement. The one at the at University of Colorado, he stepped down from one of his leading positions at the university. And a couple of years later, he moved to the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and took up a leadership role there. Another gentleman was working at the West Virginia University as a dean, and he was forced to step down from his deanship. And he also moved to someplace in the Midwest, I think it was Kansas. Mm-hmm. But so what happened to them? From the vantage point of nutrition science, working with industry is just business as usual. As an anthropologist, as an American, I find that so hard to accept, but it is the truth. And there are people out there who've been critics of the food industry role in nutrition for many, many years, and they know that that's just the way it is. So many of their colleagues were appalled that they were being brought to task for promoting a corporate-friendly science, because the position of the nutrition field, many people in it, is that that's where all the money comes from. If you look at the funding for scientific research changes over time, it's easy to see that government money has been sinking for a very long time. And people are increasingly needing to use corporate funds. The trick is, how can you regulate the use of corporate funds so that the interests of corporations don't influence the science? Mm-hmm. So the gentleman at the University of Southern Carolina, he passed away. But, you know, the others are still out there working. In some cases, they're writing papers that borrow ideas from the soda science that was so popular a decade ago.
Yeah. Well, you have such fascinating email exchanges that your book documents with these scientific researchers at academic institutions, essentially acting as part of Team Coke, as you call it, Team Coca-Cola. Can you talk about how Coca-Cola was able to essentially co-opt these scientists? I mean, you talked about the culture of the science research was pretty industry friendly in the United States, but it seemed like there were some other techniques that Coca-Cola was using to really make these researchers feel like they were truly on Team Coca-Cola.
Yes, well, as a matter of fact, what's so interesting, people think that the industry's been in charge and the industry's been corrupting the scientists. But what this story shows is that these scientists, could easily see that by working with Big Soda, they would get a lot more money for their research. They would have lots of opportunities for global travel, opportunities for their own ideas to become globally very influential. So in many cases, it was the academic scientists themselves who took the initiative, went to Koch, said, look, I have these really cool ideas. We can create a science that highlights the role of exercise in obesity. This is to your advantage. We can solve Koch's problem. We can solve the world's problem. This is the actual language, by promoting exercise. And so often the scientists came with these ideas to Coca-Cola. But Koch, of course, as you suggest, wanted to have people on their team. That is, people who would help promote Koch's goals. And those goals included funding either scientific conferences or scientific sessions in conferences around the world, promoting these ideas of soda science. Coca-Cola put out its own set of ethics to guide the scientists who worked with it in promoting these ideas globally. And the ethics were nothing like what your normal person would think of as ethical science. Mm-hmm. And so the company wanted these these academic scientists to adhere to its ethical rules. And in some cases they did, in other cases they didn't. But I have to tell you, these scientists really got into working with Koch. There were these, I had access to the inside emails between Koch's chief scientific officer and these academics. And there were something like 10 people on what I call Team Koch, and they were constantly emailing back and forth. I mean, just thousands of emails going back and forth over just a short number of years. And they were, you know, they were chatting about, the basic framing was that there was this huge war going on between the sciences, the soda science, they didn't call it that, of course, and the public health science. And so they created all these pejorative names for the public health people who were promoting taxes. Yeah. In a lot of chit-chat going back. And then they were trying to identify articles that had been published that were wrong thinking. And then they would work together to come up with a strategy for writing another article to challenge it. So they were actually having a lot of fun working together.
That part of the book is really fascinating to see. And of course, the universities were getting huge grants, sometimes totaling over millions of dollars. And it really ultimately undermines some of the faith that the public can have in our academic scientists, unfortunately. I do want to see if we can get a caller in here. We're just about out of time, but I want to go to Peter calling in from Florida. Peter, welcome to your call.
Hi. Yeah, you know, I have the name for your book, Science for Sale. That is really what you're talking about. Because that's what I was thinking about. It's like, and it goes way back. Remember, like cars, they didn't want seat belts because people would get the impression that driving is dangerous. And then the connection between combustible engines or whatever, fossil fuels and global warming. They knew that in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And they even went, remember, so far as like, Nat King Cole, smoking helps his digestion. How long it took the Surgeon General to say smoking's bad for your health. In other words, there's a big track record of what you're talking about, that science being for sale and basically not owing up to the reality.
Yeah, no, thank you, Peter, for putting this in context. And Susan, what's your response when people, you know, say this really undermines science from academia? What do you think we should be making of this kind of a scandal ultimately?
Well, I agree. I think we need to be very careful in understanding our science better. And it's hard for us as consumers because we're not out there reading the scientific literature. We may read reports in our local newspapers or in magazines, but we need to look and see who's funding the science that's done. And each scientific article should be followed by disclosure. Of course, scientists don't always disclose who's really funding their work, or nor do they disclose how the funding influences their work. But we need to be very savvy consumers of science, of the scientific ideas that we are being told are the ones to live our lives by. Ultimately, we have to take a lot of responsibility for this.
Well, and you make the point that industry-funded research tends to find disproportionately for industry outcomes. So we do need to be more critical and discerning. We're just about out of time, Susan, but I just wanted to ask sort of what are the next steps here? Just briefly, what can we do going forward, and what is Big Soda doing now?
Big Soda has basically given up on the exercise message. Good. But the other part, the no soda tax ever, no regulation, that's what it's working on. And public health researchers who are working in various parts of the Global South, in particular Latin America and Africa, are exposing the political strategies that these companies are using in order to form alliances with ministers of health, with sub-ministers of health, alliances with the heads of scientific research centers in order to discourage regulation. The thing is, the companies have so much money, so much more money than academics, than scientific organizations have. They have such a huge advantage. That's where we need to focus our efforts now.
Well, any resources very briefly you'd recommend for listeners?
Let me work on that one.
All right. Well, we'll put any of those resources you might be able to come up with on our website. But I just want to thank you for alerting us through this book to what is going on behind the scenes with our science, with our dieting messaging and exercise messaging, as well as these policy debates. So Harvard anthropology professor Susan Greenhall, author of Soda Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola. Thank you for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you, Ethan.
To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. And you can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review, email any show ideas and feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Maliha Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.